All right.
Please be seated.
The United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Mark A. Barnett presiding before Consolidated Court Number 23CV7, Cambria Company LLC versus United States. Will the attorneys please state your name for the record, starting with the plaintiff?
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Luke Meisner from Chagrin Associates on behalf of the plaintiff, Cambria Company LLC.
Daniel Wong on behalf of Commerce.
United States. Colin Mathias on behalf of the United States.
Sezi Arden on behalf of Antique Group.
Kaylee Bird on behalf of Hogan Lovells and the Consolidated Plaintiffs, MSI and Arizona Tile.
Jonathan Stoll, Hogan Lovells also on behalf of Consolidated Plaintiffs, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor. Jared Wessel, also from Hogan Lovells on behalf of Consolidated Plaintiffs.
All right. Good morning, everybody. I think the way I'd like to proceed this morning, I issued questions ahead of time. I'd like to focus on those questions if we could. But before we start, there's one preliminary matter I just wanted to raise with you all, and I ask this in all honesty because I haven't dealt with this situation before. Keeping in mind that we do have members of the public here, the one question I had is a procedural question with regard to what's probably the one BPI issue that folks may have some interest in discussing. As I noted in the question, I made reference to the issue in terms of a particular characteristic of the sales by Pokarna that were used to corroborate the AFA rate. Query whether that particular characteristic is or needs to continue to be protected as BPI, but the party to whom I would put that question is not before me. I haven't had that situation before, so I ask whether any of you have prior experience with a situation like that in another case, and otherwise, I guess my inclination is to give you all the homework assignment after we're done here today to reach out to Pokarna's counsel and put to them the question. I'm not talking about quantities, values, the number stuff that I know everybody, really is interested in protecting, but just that particular characteristic of those sales that's at issue here, is there any reason that we can't discuss that particular phrase, if you will, publicly? But if anyone has any other experience or better ideas, I'm happy to hear them.
Your Honor, we're happy to reach out to Pokarna and ask them if they can release that particular characteristic, make that public. I don't have any personal experience handling this, but I think from our perspective, we're happy to talk about the abstract if you want, or we could also save it till the end. And I think there's only maybe one person here who probably doesn't have access to the BPI, so who happens to be our plaintiff today, representing the company. We could always ask Mr. Shaw to leave if we want to dig into it.
Right. Okay. I mean, I'm happy to just refer to it as a particular characteristic or something. Just to use a euphemism and just keep it all public if that's amenable to everybody. I don't expect that you're, planning to get into, quantities or values, prices, et cetera, for those transactions. I don't know that that's particularly relevant to the argument. But in any case, if you feel the need, let me know and we'll punt that one to the end, I would just reach out to them, ask them to maybe, address the question in a letter that would, that could be filed through you all then, to let me know how to proceed on that particular thing. So, okay. With that, in terms of how I proceed with questions, I'm happy to have you remain at council table and just address each question from there. What I'd like to do, happy to group the questions, so in terms of the sub-questions, so we, issue or address question one, so sort of with all the subparts to it. You'll all have plenty of opportunity to speak. I would ask, just because of the number of us that are here, for purposes of the recording, that you identify yourself each time. But otherwise, you know, we'll go back and forth on each one, and when you've had your say, we'll move on to the next one. And then at the end, if you feel that there's a need to get into anything further, I'll give you that opportunity. Okay? So we'll start with question one about the regulation and the specific reference to 5 o'clock there. Maybe, I don't know if the government wants to start on this one. I'll give you all time to, you know, plenty of opportunities to go back and forth. But
unless the parties who originally raised this have an issue, we can start, Your Honor. It is, so you raised the point about the regulation setting the 5 o'clock as a default deadline.
You may want to pull the microphone a little bit closer. I mean, it's, when you're facing it, it's working fine. When you're not, it's...
Thank you, Your Honor. My apologies. We agree that it establishes an initial default deadline of 5 o'clock if there's nothing else establishing that as a deadline, otherwise nothing establishing a deadline. However, when Commerce extends a deadline, there's nothing in the text of Section 351.302 that would inhibit Commerce's ability to set a deadline at another time when granting an extension. And I have the preamble used for that regulation, where Commerce explicitly refers to noon deadlines twice within that preamble. Further, in this same administrative review, there were twice earlier that the other respondent received 10 a.m. deadlines without any objection from any party.
You're giving me statistics, but it's not, I mean, you're not addressing justification or rationale.
So it's our position that Commerce does not have to provide a justification or a rationale, that when granting an extension, Commerce may set any time it needs to.
Are you suggesting that Commerce has the ability to ignore its regulations anytime it wants to without justification?
No, Your Honor.
Why isn't this like every other regulation? If Commerce wants to depart from the standard it sets in the regulation, it needs to justify that departure on the record.
It's our view that these are two different regulations. That 351.303B sets the default deadline, but nothing within 351.302 allows Commerce to grant extensions for any other time. So it is not violating the default deadline. It is extending a deadline, setting the time necessary.
If you look at 303, I mean, it seems to be set up in a way where it suggests that the deadline, I mean, that generally speaking, it's a reference to a date. And then within that, the provisions of 303B are in fact giving more specificity. Okay, here's what it means. You know, once we've set a date, okay, on that date, whatever your deadline is, and the deadline being the day, within that day, here's what you need to do. You need to file by, you know, you need to complete the electronic filing by 5 o'clock. And it goes on to say, okay, again, on that date, if you have to manually file something, here's what you do to manually file it on that date with its time frames. Okay, I mean, why, what am I missing?
Your Honor, I believe... Our response is that 351.302 just does not, when it discusses extending deadlines, does not contain a standards or a limitation on Commerce's power to set a different deadline.
Let's take your point, all right, and say, all right, fine. It doesn't, so they can extend the date, and then we're gonna go from March 5th to March 10th, whatever it is, okay? And they don't say anything more, okay? What's the deadline? Is it now midnight on March 5th? Because they didn't specify otherwise, and 11:59 at p.m. on March 10th is still March 10th.
Yes. In that sense, I think the regulation still would then establish the default deadline of 5 p.m. Yes.
So I'm back to why doesn't – if Commerce is going to depart from the deadline established in its regulations, why doesn't it need to justify that departure? What other regulation can Commerce depart from without justification?
Your Honor, there is there's not. We state that our position is that there are two different regulations, and there are two different regulations. In Commerce, there's not a standard established by the regulation for extensions. If we look at the preamble for 351.33B, the preamble
do you have a citation for
76 Federal Register 339263, and the page number is 39264. I have a copy with me if you'd like to use the document reader.
Sure.
So when we see this regulation, is there the preamble for the purpose of this regulation is discussing how to set a deadline for electronic versus manual submissions, Our reading of this preamble is suggesting that this discussion is about not providing a benefit to electronic submissions over manual submissions. That's the purpose of this regulation, is that a electronic submission, although it could be turned in after 5 p.m., manual submissions are not able to be turned in after 5 p.m. Because Commerce is not open. That, in our view, is the purpose of this specific regulation. It is not setting a constraint on Commerce's power to specify deadlines in other circumstances.
Okay. So, has Commerce ever provided, I mean, you started to, before I cut you off and sort of tried to focus you back on the first couple of questions, talk about the fact that, well, yeah, Commerce has done this other times, a couple other times, you know, whatever the number is, doesn't really matter. Has Commerce ever provided a justification for a departure from 5 o'clock?
In my review of this administrative review and the other times Commerce has set deadlines at other times, Commerce has not. It puts a time on the extension request, and that no parties ever raise an objection to Commerce's power to do that. I have the twice other times in this review that a 10 a.m. deadline was set, if you'd like to see.
Let me just ask this. Was it after the instance at stake in this litigation?
No. In this review, they were for the other respondents' first supplemental questionnaire. So earlier deadlines than this deadline.
Okay. But they were presumably deadlines applicable to Pokarna and not Antique.
Awesome.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. These are specific deadlines for Pokarna. They were Pokarna's extension request.
Right. But not Antique. So this was the first time this had arisen for Antique Group.
As far as I'm aware, yes, it is. And I don't want to assume I don't know to what ability respondents look at each other's deadlines in administrative reviews.
Mm-hmm. Okay. To what extent the fact that they missed the deadline, but they filed before 5 o'clock was, especially the initial submissions by Antique Group were focused on the fact that, you know, whoops, we missed it. We didn't realize, you know, yeah, you can say, okay, it was there in the supplemental questionnaire and it was in bold, whatever. We missed it. When we calendared it, we just made a mistake. We forgot to note the fact that it was 10 o'clock and not 5 o'clock. Government seems to acknowledge the fact that, you know, I mean, I think it's acknowledged by your regulations that 5 o'clock is the standard and anything but 5 o'clock is not ordinary. Where and how did Commerce consider its own setting of a non-5 o'clock deadline as part of its analysis of whether there were extraordinary circumstances present for purposes of granting an extension after the fact?
Yes. So we'll go to I'll refer to you to page 17 of the IDM, where Commerce discusses this. Because I one of the parties not present here in this litigation raised this in its case brief. And Commerce recognized that these initial deadlines of 5 p.m. exist, that there's nothing that limits its power to set other deadlines, and because it happened earlier in this review and because it happened in other cases, Antique should have been on notice that Commerce sets other deadlines.
But so they basically denied that it was an unusual circumstance.
Yes, Commerce denied it was an unusual circumstance.
Okay. Okay. Anything further on the first four? You want to first four subparts, or you want to continue on to the last?
Yeah, no. Your Honor, I would just add, Commerce does explain that all deadlines, Commerce must have the discretion to set its own deadlines for these are statutory. Commerce has statutory deadlines for its work, and setting its own deadlines is essential to moving that work forward.
So what was so special here that you know, even if it's unstated, I mean, I don't know if there's any, is there anything in the record anywhere that explains why it was necessary for Commerce to set a 10 a.m. deadline in this particular date rather than 5?
Your Honor, Commerce is never so explicit as to state it must have these documents at 10 a.m. or else it cannot complete the review. No. Commerce does maintain that this was a second supplemental questionnaire. It's a complex company organization, a conglomerate of four other
companies. We're talking about a difference of 5 hours, though. I mean, I get, you know, look, I'm sympathetic to all the burdens that Commerce has with regard to analyzing questionnaire responses, getting the stuff more or less on time, having to meet their statutory deadlines, you know, juxtaposing or, you know, considering all that within the construct of, you know, these analysts are also doing other cases. They may have a verification set up. They may have to get on an airplane. Okay. That's not my question. I mean, I get all of that. We're talking here about 10 o'clock versus 5 o'clock and a submission that came in within that very limited gap period. So that if Commerce went and looked back at its regulations and said, yeah, well, that is our norm, and they filed within the normal deadline, okay, maybe we need to take that into account, explain, you know, address that question of the complexity and all the things that Commerce has to do within that specific set of facts. Is there anything specific to this case that helps, you know, that gives me comfort in Commerce's approach that says, gee, you know, this was the last set of information. The analysts were getting on a plane the next day, and they needed to have a chance to take a look at this stuff before they got on the plane to go to verification, okay? Those are facts that are relevant that say, hey, 10 o'clock, okay. Maybe that's a reasonable deadline in this factual scenario. Any of those facts?
Your Honor, Commerce does not put that to paper in this review.
Do they otherwise exist?
I mean,
that's what, in a sense, that's what question that subpart E is about, is to say, look, is there any point, you know, is there something in the record here or something that suggests that I need to remand this for Commerce to better address 10 o'clock versus 5 o'clock, as opposed to saying, if I don't find justification for 10 o'clock instead of 5 o'clock, well, you didn't have the justification, and you can't go make it up after the fact. They met the 5 o'clock deadline that's provided for in the regulations, and so take it.
Your Honor, the missed deadline date, May 16th, was a Monday at 10 a.m. I think there could be something behind a decision to have something due at 10 a.m. on a Monday, as opposed to before the weekend. The first thing to start a new week could be Commerce suggesting a desire to start a new week with new information to examine it. That's not on the record, though, Your Honor.
Well, the fact that it was a Monday is on the record.
Yes.
So they're capable of taking judicial notice of what day of the week. Okay. All right.
But for 1E, Your Honor, Commerce would seek the benefits of Regents versus DHS v. Regents, and if remanded, would seek to do either of its two options.
Under Regents, I mean, if you're trying to say Regents applies here, okay, what do you have to hook into? You got to have some hook then that says, okay, we're taking a reason that existed at the time that we made the determination, and we're providing a better explanation of it. I don't see anything on this record. In fact, you told me that there isn't anything reflected on this record that explains why 10 o'clock versus 5 o'clock. So how does Regents suggest that I got to give you something?
We're more concerned about Commerce at this point takes the position that there is not a standard requiring a Commerce to provide a justification for varying from that deadline and establishing the need to put a justification. Commerce would want to be able to revisit what qualifies as that justification.
Okay. We'll give Mr. Mathias a chance to breathe and so on for a few minutes. Anybody else want to chime in on the first set of questions?
Hogan Lovell, Your Honor. May I approach?
Please.
It's usually DOJ that just can't help themselves and they have to stand up.
But so before I say, Your Honor, I'm going to put the monitor. I just have a difficulty seeing you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, Jonathan Stoll from Hogan Lovell for the record, Your Honor. Thank you for the questions. Your Honor, we think you've put your finger upon one of the key issues in this case. The department's own regulations plainly establish a 5 p.m. deadline. With all due respect to Mr. Mathias, I think that's clear from the text. They talk about having to make electronic filings by 5 p.m. They talk about having to make manual filings by 5 p.m. So they establish this presumptive deadline. Now, it is true that the courts have said, and we don't disagree with this, that there are situations where the Commerce Department may change its deadlines, either the date or possibly the time. Mr. Wessel and I were conferring about exactly the scenario you talked about, Your Honor, where you have a verification coming and you need something to be verified beforehand. So Commerce would establish a 10 a.m. deadline so that they would have the information in advance. But that's not the situation here, Your Honor, as you pointed out. Nowhere in the original letter granting the extension, nowhere in any of the responses to Antique's requests, nowhere in the preliminary results or in the final results, is there any discussion about why 10 a.m. was necessary. And that's particularly probative here, Your Honor, where in good faith, I don't believe the government or Mr. Meisner from representing Cambria is contesting that there was something about some bad faith here, Your Honor, where Antique was gaming the system. That would be a very different situation. But here's a situation where a respondent worked hard. They made a mistake. They filed between 2:56 p.m. and 3:45 p.m. on the very same day. That means that the government's reason for a 10 a.m. deadline has to be given, some examination. It may be a time when it's not required, as Mr. Mathias is pointing out. But here, where it has consequences, you do have to look at the reasoning for the 10 a.m. They offered none, Your Honor. And I think that's, particularly probative here because, after all, it was only 5 hours. There was a lot of time, 45 days before the final results. I think if you look at this court's decision.
Preliminary results, right?
Preliminary results, excuse me. More time for the final results. If you look at the court's decisions in Grovest, Artisan, Boson Tools, those cases all talk about how Commerce has to act in a way that's remedial and not punitive. They also talk about how Commerce has to take into account calculating an accurate dumping margin as much as possible. Here, where you're penalizing a company for 5 hours late and you don't give any reason for why they had to file at 10 a.m., that, Your Honor, I think, the decisions in Oman Fastener as well as Salih Khalat suggest that's not a reasonable decision. No matter what, Commerce has to act reasonably. And so by establishing a deadline for no reason and then essentially punishing a company for missing that deadline, that's not a reasonable approach. I think it's either an abuse of discretion or it could be considered arbitrary and capricious. But either way, I think Commerce has acted unreasonably here, Your Honor. I think also that we talked a little bit about, or you did, Your Honor, about this particular deadline. I mean, yes, there are situations where 10 a.m., including with respect to Picarna, Your Honor, where that deadline is used. But Commerce itself admits in the IND memo at 17, Your Honor, that this deadline is, quote, not utilized regularly. So that goes to the issue about whether or not there are, in fact, extraordinary circumstances here, Your Honor. I think in this situation where there is nothing that's been provided for why you need the deadline, you had a deadline that's earlier than expected, the party acted in good faith, those are extraordinary circumstances. We don't need to get into whether or not COVID impacted their filing, the size of the filing, all the issues about traveling in India. Those are all additional things that mattered at the time, Your Honor. But those things, I think, are, really are not to the central issue, which is, was the deadline unusual?
They're not reasons why the 10 a.m. deadline was missed. I mean, and that's part of what clouds this record here is that Antique Group didn't say, look, we made a mistake. That's all it is. That is the extraordinary circumstances. You changed the time on us. We missed it, and therefore we missed it. And that is simply the extraordinary circumstance. Then they went on to say about all the things that they were doing to try to get done before the end of that day, none of which has nothing to do with missing the 10 a.m. deadline.
That's very fair, Your Honor. I think what I would, in terms of the context for those comments, I think it's important to consider those as part of Antique's request for a second chance, or as I was referring to it presently, the last chance, application of the last chance doctrine. I mean, I think what they were saying to Commerce, again, in good faith, was We recognize we made a mistake. I think counsel, who is no longer on this case, they've now been replaced about twice by U.S. counsel as a result of the seriousness of the situation, admitted that he had made a mistake and was trying to explain the reason for his mistake. I think that goes to why this is very important, I think, and distinguishes some of this court's other findings, Your Honor. It was 3 days later, so just make sure we're all on the same timeline. March 11 was the request for extension that we're talking about. Was the grant of the extension. No mention of why, the 10 a.m. deadline. The 16th, they filed between 256 and 345. And then on May 18th, when they're told by Commerce that they had missed the deadline, first time they realized it, they immediately filed a letter saying, we ask you basically for leniency, and we explained that we are going to undertake certain measures to make sure that this error doesn't happen again. That's exactly what this court discussed in Oman Fasteners, referring to corrosion-resistant steel from Korea, where another fellow law firm, and Your Honor, I mean, Mr. Wessel and I were talking about this. I mean, we have combined between us more than 40 years of experience. I mean, these are heart attack moments for counsel. Unfortunately, these things do happen. You're in the middle of a filing and you realize, hey, guys, we forgot to create a public version. I mean, these things do happen. Obviously, you would hope that you would file an extension request. They should have done that here, but they didn't realize that the deadline was 5 p.m. Again, I don't think there's any question about good faith. But as a result, they asked for the application of the second chance doctrine, Your Honor, which was discussed in Oman Fasteners as well as in other cases.
For the record, Oman Fasteners is on appeal, right?
It is, Your Honor, but I would point you to Trinity Manufacturing. There are several cases that discuss this. I know the government, and I would characterize it as Your Honor, as a half-hearted effort in their brief. It seems to claim that this practice no longer exists. I would point to you that if that's the government's position, they should put out a Federal Register notice. They should clearly say in every case now on that this practice does not exist, because, again, you have this court saying it does exist, not once, but several times. You have instances, I believe the government admits in a footnote as recently as 2023, where the government admits that it exists. So, again, for a respondent that was trying in good faith to do something, made a mistake, for them to then ask for the application of that, to me that's a situation where the Commerce Department should have reasonably agreed to give them that chance, especially where they outlined, again, 3 days after they missed the deadline, they said, we will undertake these additional things to prevent this from happening again. And then they said it again, and then their U.S. counsel repeated it again in June. So they clearly tried to avoid it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. Yeah. I mean, I've got, question two gets to Oman Fasteners, and
that's right.
You can get into that as much as you'd like at that point. I mean, is there anything in particular you want to say, in response? I mean, Mr. Mathias makes the point that, 351.303, where the 5 o'clock deadline is set, is not, slightly putting words in his mouth, it's not inconsistent with 302, which says Commerce can extend any deadline, and it's not limiting 302 in the sense that you can extend a deadline, 5 o'clock, I'll give you till 8:30 tomorrow morning for the, as happens in the situation where an extension request comes in late in the day before Commerce has an opportunity to respond to it, or we'll give you till noon tomorrow or something like that if you ran into some issue, internet was down, whatever the case may be. How do I think about those that issue, the relationship between 302 and 303?
I mean, I think the government is correct that there are, in fact, two different regulations. I mean, there are two parts of the regulation. But I think Your Honor's questions, 1A in particular, are going to the question of, when they establish a new deadline, do they have to provide some justification? I would respectfully disagree with the government. They said they're saying we have fiat. I mean, we're a nation of laws. There has to be a rationale for why you do something. And there are, I think, instances in which there are other letters where even if they don't specify exactly why, they might say the preliminary results are only so many days away. They didn't do that here. It was a very generic letter. I don't know the reasons. I can't speak to whether it was because they wanted it early on a Monday. So I think that is one crucial point that Your Honor has pointed. They always have to act reasonably. I think by not doing that, it was per se unreasonable. And then secondly, we have to evaluate the consequence of the failure, which I think your other questions in questions one go to. Here, they offered no reason for why they needed it by 10 a.m. To have a consequence like this, I think to quote, I think it's Salih Khalad, it's grossly disproportionate. I mean,
if they came to you and said, we absolutely need this because, you know, verification starts tomorrow and we need to review, okay, that gives you a very clear reason for why you need something and the timeliness of it. Here, where there's no explanation and there seems to be plenty of time, I don't believe the government disputes that the amount of time that was remaining for them was significant, that has to be weighed and again, shows that the behavior wasn't reasonable, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honor, if I may, I have a few brief comments on the first question.
Well, maybe before...
Pardon me, if they want to go first, that's fine.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if Ms. Erden wanted to add anything.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Desi Erden. I'm here on behalf of Antique Group from Trade Pacific Law. I wanted to start with 1A, to what extent must Commerce justify a departure from a 5 p.m. deadline? In this case, it was very important for Commerce to justify a departure from a 5 p.m. deadline. A deadline of 10 a.m. occurs less than 0.5% of the time in AD or CVD investigations and reviews. As equity demands, since 10 a.m. deadline is so rare, an anti-group was pro se, Commerce should have provided...
They weren't. I mean, I know you say that multiple times in your brief, but they weren't pro se. They had local counsel in India that was helping them, right?
They did have a consultant company helping them. They did not have licensed U.S. counsel helping them. At the time, this submission was...
And then I think the question is really getting more at the general standard. I mean, you know, 5 o'clock is set by regulation. Okay, it's not so much a case-specific question as to whether, on this one here, whether the facts justified it, but whether, you know, as a general matter, if Commerce wants to depart from a standard that is set, that it itself has set by regulation, what justification does it need to provide to depart from its own regulatory standard?
They need to provide an explanation because they did not provide an explanation. Our client was not...
Can we put this within the construct of administrative law practice?
They weren't meaningfully notified of this 10 a.m. Deadline.
What do you mean by that? Because, I mean, how else should Commerce have notified your client, they put it in the letter, in the supplemental questionnaire itself, and I think put it in bold, in fact. So how much more adequate does that notice have to be? Does it have to be big type? Does it have to be, you know, what do they need to do?
Yeah, the way it was inconspicuous, so you couldn't really see it. It was sort of hidden. And because the client was pro se, you know, they weren't...
This is a little different than what I understood your client to have argued on the record, was that it was a mistake. I mean, I don't think they argued that Commerce failed to adequately notify them. I think they argued, we made a mistake, we missed it. And I think they, at least at the time, tried to own it and say, all right, you know, honest mistakes are made, as Mr. Stoll kind of alluded to. People make mistakes.
Yes.
I mean, Department of Justice itself has miscalendared deadlines on occasion.
Yes, they did make a mistake, but Commerce could have provided an explanation and justification as why they departed from the 5 p.m., and that way the client would have...
But Ms. Erden, help me out here, though. As a matter of administrative law,
mm-hmm.
Okay, yes, they could have done that. Is there a legal principle that says they had... What is your argument as to what the legal principle is that says they had to, they should have?
Well, the traditional notions of justice and equity, I would say, are important for pro se clients. And also in Mitsu and Company versus U.S., a CIT case from 1994, it says that Commerce must provide plaintiffs a meaningful opportunity to participate in a review. So,
okay.
That's 1A for me.
Okay.
And then 1B, did Commerce provide a sufficient justification in this case? Remarkably, Commerce never offered any explanation regarding the departure from the 5 p.m. deadline or how the 5 p.m. deadline would have a meaningful negative impact on its preparation of the results of the administrative review. The final results lack any references to the factual circumstances of this case that would demonstrate the actual impact or hindrance experienced by the agency as a result of a 5 p.m. deadline. Given the ample 45-day time frame prior to the preliminary results and 228 days left for the final results, Commerce claims of undue burden are not supported by substantial evidence.
Okay.
And then for 1C, as Commerce admitted, Commerce does not provide when these deadlines are utilized based on specific facts in proceedings. However, in their final memorandum in this case, they did provide general criteria stating that deadlines depend upon the timeline of the proceeding, the needs of Commerce, and the needs of the responding party. However, Commerce did not explain specifically the facts of Antique Group's case. Therefore, it was not clear what the timeline of the proceeding meant, and it seems like the responding party's needs weren't considered at all. In our case, the delay was only 5 hours.
Well, the needs of they were considered in the sense that they granted you a partial extension.
Prior to rejecting the last one, yeah. There was plenty of time for Commerce to calculate an anti-dumping margin. And then for 1D, the extraordinary circumstances, the 10 a.m. deadline occurs less than 0.5% of the time, so it is an unexpected
event. What's the basis for that statistic?
Huh? Sorry?
What's the basis for that statistic?
So this was submitted by the law firm prior to this. It's on the record. Commerce stated that they within a time period, they say that they set a 10 a.m. deadline, and then they divided that by the total number of deadlines set, and then they got this 0.5%.
Okay. This is another law firm, not yours, that supposedly did some calculation.
They did a calculation, yes, and it's on the record.
The calculation itself or the fact that they previously just stated 0.05%?
The calculations on the record.
Okay.
They don't just state it. They have all the cases, like, in the exhibit.
Okay.
Which is an unexpected event as required by the regulations. Since the deadline was supposed to be 5 p.m., respondents couldn't have been reasonably expected to file any extension requests. Further, the court has clarified that Commerce may not enforce this extraordinary circumstances rule in a manner that produces an unjust or punitive result. In 2022, the CIT also decided that Commerce may not enforce its extraordinary circumstances rule in a manner that produces an unjust or punitive result. The determined margin over 300% is punitive, and it does not reflect an accurate dumping margin. And then for 1E, this court should remand this case with instruction to Commerce to accept Antique's second supplemental questionnaire response and to calculate Antique's AB margin based on Antique's actual reported sales and cost data.
Well, those are two separate things, right? There is no basis for me to do the latter. I mean, even if I do the first part, mm-hmm. send it back and say, you need to accept it, there's no justification, or what justification is there for the court to require Commerce to use the data to provide a final calculation? Because at the end of the day, Commerce hasn't yet analyzed the information that was contained in that supplemental response. It could, for all I know, for all you, for all anybody knows in this room, the response itself could be garbage. They could say, well, we looked through it. They, yes, while they responded to a couple of questions, at the end of the day, they didn't provide the actual information that the agency needs to do a calculation. I'm not saying that's the case. It could also be that they say, hey, this is great. This answers every single one of our questions, and now we can go do a calculation. I don't know. There's no basis for the court to presume the answer to that question, right?
Yes. Commerce can do its own analysis of if they of the sales and cost data. Yes, I agree with that.
Okay.
And the record contains adequate information, and Commerce should use the information on the record. The five-hour delay should not be an administrative death penalty. This is disproportionate and unwarranted. There's not any plausible explanation that Commerce could give for its abuse of discretion and arbitrary conduct. So it should not be remanded for explanation.
Okay. Before we turn to Mr. Meisner, yes, Mr. Stoll, you may want to help. Did you want to help out in response to that last point?
No, before we turn to Mr. Meisner, I just wanted to respond to the government's earlier comment. I think on this record, while I concur with Your Honor that, of course, Commerce will have to analyze the questionnaire and evaluate it, and unfortunately, Frantic may have some more questions for Frantic about the responses, I do believe, Your Honor, that remand for purposes of assessing whether to accept the questionnaire, we believe, would not be correct at this point. Commerce had ample time, again, to Your Honor's first question. They could have explained, you know, why they were establishing the 10 a.m. deadline. They did not. They could have, in response to Antique's request for reconsideration, explained why they needed those 5 hours. They did not. Nowhere in the preliminary results or the final results did they explain that. So I think, Your Honor, that the appropriate instruction from you is that they should accept the filing and the data, and then, as Your Honor has suggested, they should go ahead and analyze it for purposes of calculating a margin, and they may have further questions for the respondent at that time, Your Honor.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honor. I believe it's still morning. Luke Meisner on behalf of Cambria again.
And we're on question one yet.
I believe Mr. Mathias has done an excellent job overall, so I'm going to keep my comments very brief and save most of my powder for how we're appearing as plaintiff on the Oliver's rate. So a couple of brief observations. So first, the regulation in question 351.303 begins with in general. And that's a signal that while the 5 p.m. deadline does apply in general, Commerce can and will depart from it when it believes it's appropriate to do so.
I take your point. I'm not saying they can't. I don't think the question presumes that they can't depart from it. I think the question presumes, like most other regulations that start off in general, where the agency wants to depart from it, it has to provide a reasoned basis for departing.
I understand exactly where you're coming from, Your Honor, but I think we would be going down a slippery, dangerous road if we started requiring Commerce to explain the rationale for every time it grants an extension.
I don't think we're talking about that. I think we're talking about if the statistics are to be believed, the 0.05% of times when Commerce tries to depart from 5 o'clock. I mean, I think that is where 302 comes in. They have a regulation that talks about deadlines, in which, as I mentioned, I think the rest of the regulations here, when you look at it in context, deadline generally refers to a date. And you have then the specific regulation that talks about, okay, on a given date, whatever your deadline date is, the time frame is, you got to get it in by 5 because we're keeping everybody on an equivalent basis.
I think when Commerce decides when it sets the deadline, including the date and the time, if parties are allowed to run to the court and say, well, I asked for a 2-week extension, but I was only granted 8 days, and Commerce didn't explain why that is, I don't see there too much daylight between that
kind
of
complaint. No, I think, there's plenty of court cases there that say we're not going to get into reviewing, you know, their evaluation of good cause for an extension.
And I think it's the same thing here when, you know, antique has already...
But there isn't any... There's a different question between my reweighing the reason that they provided for saying, okay, I'm only giving you 8 days versus 12, or whatever the case may be. Not going to, you know, reweigh that. But if they give note, they make some other change, they change the time frame with absolutely no discussion of it whatsoever, no explanation. That's the question I'm trying to get at here.
I think the explanation is evident on its face because, you know, we're all lawyers here and we have to meet deadlines. And if I've already requested an extension and received it twice, and the agency comes back to me and says, well, the deadline is going to be Monday morning after the weekend, 10 a.m. That's a signal that the agency is losing its patience, perhaps believes that I'm trying to run the clock out because this is the second supplemental with over 60 questions. And so, you know, I'm not going to get any more extensions. This is the final one. I better meet it. I got the benefit of the weekend. That was nice of Commerce to do because it could have set it at Friday at 5 p.m., but they set it at Monday at 10 a.m. And so if we start trying to lift the lid up, though, and require Commerce to explain, well, why do they set it at 10 a.m. on Monday instead of 5 p.m. Friday or 5 p.m. on Monday, I think it's a slippery slope.
Okay. Anything further you wanted to add on that?
No, Your Honor.
Any of the other subparts? Okay.
Your Honor, just a few points, if I may. Your Honor, just to address a couple points my colleagues have made. I wanted to first confirm that the deadline was clearly identified in the request for 10 a.m. It's bolded. A reasonable party would have been aware. Regarding the calculation of the 0.5%, that
0.5 or 0.05?
I believe it was 0.5. Okay. I will have to check. I do not have the case brief that was submitted that contained that. It was by one of the all other parties who made an appearance during a review. They submitted a case brief that relied on in Commerce's rejection of the second untimely request. They said that, Commerce has set a 10 a.m. deadline more than 10 times in the first 5 months of 2022. I believe what the calculation did is it then calculated the number of reviews Commerce does a year, divided that into five-twelfths of the year, and 10 divided by that number to determine the 0.5%.
In reality, it could be a much smaller percentage then, because within any of those reviews, there's multiple parties and multiple deadlines and multiple extensions, et cetera. So the fact is, it's probably actually more rare.
But if that's your
explanation of the statistic.
We would just like to add that Commerce was not saying it only happened 5 times, 10 times, Your Honor. Like this letter said, it's happened at least 10 times. Commerce is a large organization.
Absolute numbers don't mean anything, right? I mean, if Commerce has, you know, if it's 10 times out of 10,000 deadlines, that's pretty unusual, right?
You're right, but it did happen twice in this specific review earlier.
To the other party.
Regarding, I just want to point a little bit more regulatory language out in that 351.302B allows Commerce to extend any time. This is what enables Commerce to extend the time limits. It does not contain any limiting language. So that is the final thing I'd like to point out, in addition to Mr. Mesner's comments.
All right. Anybody else feel like there's something additional that we didn't cover yet on questions one. Okay. Let's turn to two, Oman fasteners, et cetera. Who wants to take the first crack?
I would be happy to.
Okay, go for it.
Your Honor, it continues to be the position of the United States that the second chance practice is not Commerce's current practice. And to rely on that, we would point the court to the 2020 decision, Wind Towers from Vietnam. I'll get a citation for you in a moment. And it is off the reference.
Are you talking about the commerce determination in Wind Towers as opposed to a court?
The IDM in Wind Towers from Vietnam.
Okay. And where they said maybe we're trying to move away from it, but then we have a number of court decisions that say, yeah, that may be your desire, but I'm not sure that you've really done that, and you've in fact.
Your Honor, our response is that the parties have only identified the only cases that the parties have identified that reference a second chance opportunity occur pre 2018. The 2023 letter that they cite, I'll bring it up to the document review for you. So this is the large diameter welded pipe from Greece, 2023. In this, we see a case about a timely extension request received before 5 p.m., which then the respondent has everything submitted by 5:03 on the same day as the timely extension request submitted at the last minute. Nowhere in this letter does Commerce refer to a second chance practice, and my understanding of how Oman Fasteners describes this second chance practice is that it is limited to untimely extension requests and missed deadlines. This, given it was a timely extension request, it does not appear to be related to this practice. Other than this, we are left solely with pre-2018 decisions. We've done a review of any of Commerce's practices since 2020, and we haven't identified at this time letters specifically referring to a second chance practice. The language in Wind Towers is rather clear, in my opinion, that Commerce views it as not in line with the regulations, and it will not be using it moving forward.
So, but Wind Towers was the review itself is after 2018. So you're saying that the court incorrectly, you know, relied on pre 2018. The court was incorrect in Oman Fasteners in terms of the what it understood as Commerce's practice.
Yes, Your Honor. I will note it is as you referenced, it's currently on appeal.
Right.
So in that extent, it is this is not the current practice of Commerce. Regarding the rest of your questions for your question two, so you asked if there is a need for Commerce to address it. I disagree, Your Honor. There's no need to address it as a result of the Wind Towers decision. And if you were to require Commerce to address the second chance practice, there's nothing in the record that indicates whether Antique Group would be entitled to the benefits of it. It's not Commerce's current practice, so that they don't have that implementation in place to make that assessment at this time.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Durden or Mr. Stoll or anyone else?
Oh, good, Your Honor.
As we submitted in our briefs, Your Honor, we do believe that Antique Group asked for the application of the second chance doctrine, explained why it was eligible, explained the things that it was going to do in order to take advantage of the second chance doctrine, and thus it was entitled to that consideration by Commerce. Obviously, that was denied. My friend from DOJ seems to be saying that there's not a practice. I think, as Commerce has said, Your Honor, in order for it to you know, I think, cease a practice, it needs to do more than making one decision in one case. You know, for example, the fact that this court, as recently as last year, found, I think, very strongly, in fact, even chastised the government in its opinion by saying that there was a practice.
Well, I mean, look, we're not. Part of it is time matters. Okay, so I mean, part of their point is, well, you know, we've changed the regulation. We now have this extraordinary circumstance standard stated in the regulation. We think we thought we made it clear in Vietnam Wind Towers that, you know, yeah, that the point of the change in the regulation is to do away with, to establish a different standard, to establish extraordinary circumstances as the standard. Question is, can you point me to any, you know, let's first talk about whether the second chance doctrine continues to exist. Can you point me to anything post 2018 in terms of, you know, administrative proceeding where Commerce in fact provided for it?
Before I turn to that, I think I just want to address the fact that my friend seems to be relying upon the 2013 regulation as the reason for why it doesn't exist. But for example, the decision discussed extensively in Oman Fasteners was in 2018. So clearly it was after the regulation. So I'm not sure if my friend is saying that we have a regulation, but we admit that we've been applying it inconsistently. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. I think the Supreme Court, the Federal Circuit, this court have been clear that you cannot do that. I'm not aware of any new regulation or even a, you know, sometimes they put out bold policy bulletins that's made this clearer to the trade. That in fact this practice no longer exists. I think in terms of the question of post 2020, we have not done an extensive search, Your Honor. I think there's probably, as counsel was alluding to, some questions about things that are filed after the deadline, where, you know, it's not clear from the record whether we don't know what happened behind the scenes, whether the last chance doctrine or second chance doctrine was invoked. I mean,
you mentioned earlier that, you know, combined you've got 40 years of experience. I mean, here's the question. I mean, we're all human, okay?
Right. Yes, Your Honor.
People make mistakes. People miss calendar deadlines, et cetera. So do we have examples, you know, in the last 5-6 years where somebody made a mistake, miscalendared a deadline, and explained after the fact, my mistake, I'm owning it, I miscalendered the deadline, that's the extraordinary circumstance that I'm citing to. I mean, for court purposes, I mean, we use excusable neglect. As I said, parties, including the government, have, you know, fessed up to, you know, having engaged in, you know, what we all accept as excusable neglect, making a mistake, addressing it after the fact. Do we have that practice? You know, can you point me to something here that says, well, that is, you know, fits within, whether you want to call it now extraordinary circumstance or a second chance doctrine, whatever the case may be, that says Commerce is going to accept the filing after the fact?
Well, I do think actually, you know, Amon Fasteners itself, I mean, is an example where that happened. I mean, where that happened. I think this court was concerned about the fact that what seemed like a very reasonable mistake was essentially being treated in a punitive and non-remedial way, which, again, looking at the court's findings and Artisan and Grobest and others, you know, had trouble with that. I think there are other cases, Salih Khalad is another case, which I think discusses that. I think I want to be candid with this court. I think what makes this case unusual and why, unfortunately, we're all here today is that it was an honest mistake. I think
I want to be candid with the court. I think what's different about this case is that those were a situation, was the error was made and folks were trying to remedy it sort of at the time. Here, from all accounts, my friends and he simply didn't understand what the deadline was, and so they missed the deadline. And so I do think that makes it unusual. That's why I submitted to you earlier, Your Honor, and I think it's a reason why the doctrine should have applied here, that applying this court's findings, past holdings, there has to be a reasonableness to Commerce's action. Just as it's not reasonable to issue a deadline without giving an explanation, it's not reasonable when a party comes to you, says you made a mistake, and offers to do the right things, where there was no adverse impact on commerce. You have to weigh these things, despite the regulation. You still have an obligation of reasonableness. And so when you take the facts in as a whole, you still have an obligation of reasonableness. And again, they came to, Antiques Council came to, or representative came to the Commerce Department 3 days afterwards and said, we made a mistake, we're going to do these things and correct it. That seems like a reasonable approach, particularly where, again, Commerce, Your Honor's comments this morning, there's no evidence that Commerce was getting on a plane, going to verification, needed the information right then. That's a different set of facts. As I explained earlier, nowhere in Commerce's responses to Antiques' request is there any evidence that this, five-hour, roughly, deference made any difference whatsoever. At 45 days until the preliminary results, very significant more time until the final results, it's simply not a reasonable approach to this. And I do think, Your Honor, one thing I wanted to add was that it's particularly interesting when you consider that Commerce has given parties the ability to refile at, before opening hours. So there you had more than, you're giving a party more than 12 hours to refile. Here we had 5 hours of difference. So if somebody filed, misses the 5 p.m. deadline, Commerce says, according to its preamble, that you are given another chance to file before the opening of business. That's what they
do. Well, that's if they file an extension request and right. The agency doesn't have time to rule on it.
Right. But here, there's only 4.5 or 5 hours difference. So they clearly, as a matter of routine, give that kind of extension because that's what they say is how they treat things that they haven't granted. But here, with only 5 hours, they're not willing to do that, particularly where a party comes to them in good faith and says, we made a mistake, and we're going to take steps to correct it.
Theoretically, the other difference is that we're talking business hours versus non-business hours. But
that's true. And again, the situation might be different, and this goes to my comment about why I don't think a remand for further explanation is appropriate here, Your Honor. If they had said in any of their letters back to NT, or in the preliminary results, or in the final results, we were doing X and Y and needed the information, that would be a different case, Your Honor. But I don't think post hoc they can explain to this court, well, we needed the information by 10 a.m. because we were going to do this or that with it. That would be different. They didn't do that. And they can't justify it now on remand, Your Honor. We don't think that's appropriate, Your Honor. Okay. I just make sure I don't have anything else. I think that's all of this time, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Urban, did you want to add anything?
Yes. This is Sandy Arden for Antique Group. And for 2A, the Antique Group not only was a first-time offender, but also took remedial steps to prevent future late filings. Based on the Amman holding, Commerce should have given Antique Group a second chance to file. And I had a printed stack of papers that where parties received a second chance, but when I looked at them, I did see they are from before 2018. But I did have one from 2023, if you would like to look at that one.
Is it the one that Mr. Mathias showed us on the screen, on the monitor?
I don't think it was that one. No.
Large diameter welded pipe, pipe
no,
in Greece?
This one's different.
Okay.
But here, this is, I'll just show it up there. Oh, here's one with a second chance.
Can I see further up just to see what case we're talking about here? Okay, the tomato suspension agreement.
On the case for
Congress. Well, I mean, it's kind of a little late in the litigation for that purpose. But on the other hand, I mean, the example that you give, I mean, not only does Commerce apply the wrong standard, but applies it of its own volition, with apparently without a request, to accept a late filing. So, okay. I don't know. We'll see if Mr. Mathias has a response to that example, but. Okay. Did you have something further? Or?
Yes. I'll move on to B. The antique group not only was a first-time offender, but also took remedial steps. And the remedial steps can be found in our brief on pages 20 and 21. Would you like me to go through them, or is that okay? Is that enough?
I mean, if you provided in your brief, that's yes. Sufficient. I've read the briefs. I mean, yeah, the point of argument is to, you know, provide further explanation. So, okay? Is that it? Okay. Mr. Meisner, did you want to jump in on anything on Oman Fasteners and question two? Or?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Mathias?
If I may borrow that tomato suspension briefly and just.
Your Honor, I'll keep this brief. We have not reviewed this extensively, but this appears to be a case where a filing was submitted 13 minutes late, and Commerce, for good cause, accepted it. I'll point to the statute that nowhere in this does Commerce reference a second chance practice. This is at best an isolated incident. But I will.
I mean, you agree it's the wrong standard, right?
I agree.
This is not a good cause situation. It's supposed to be extraordinary circumstances, right?
For untimely extension requested, it's supposed to be.
Is there an extension request referenced in the document? And is there any reason? And does the good cause that's cited by the agency have anything to do with the good cause as to why it was late, as opposed to why they're ignoring the fact that it was late and say, well, our good cause is we really wanted to look at this document.
So Your Honor, the good cause is that we really want to look at this document. It does not reference an extension request, and I'll just, the regulation 351.302B allows Commerce to extend time limits for good cause without limitation.
Okay. Anything else on number two? Turn to number three, Duntye Peak. Anybody want to start us off there?
I'm happy to approach, Your Honor, if that's okay.
Please do.
Jonathan Stoll again for the record, Your Honor. I think Duntye Peak shows, Your Honor, and I think all parties actually today agree, including just the exchange we just had about the Commerce's acceptance of some information after the deadline, that the facts really do matter. And from our perspective, Your Honor, Dong Tai Peak is in fact a very different case. Just to go through the facts of Dong Tai Peak, Your Honor, the supplemental questionnaire in that case was due on April 17, 2012. Dong Tai Peak then filed an extension request 2 days after the deadline. So they did nothing on the date of the due date. Again, just to point out one obvious difference here, Antique filed 5 hours late, believing that they were filing timely on the very same day, Your Honor. Then they filed yet another letter asking for good cause, saying that an extension be granted. And then nearly 10 days after the deadline had passed, Your Honor, on April 27, they filed their supplemental questionnaire response. I think that's obviously a different fact pattern and why you do have to look at the facts. I think also very importantly in that case, Your Honor, and a very significant contrast with this case, in that case, Commerce explained, Your Honor, that Dong Tai Peak in previous reviews had had challenges providing evidence of bona fide sales. And so Commerce pointed to that specifically as a reason for why they were concerned about the 10 days, again, 10 days, not 5 hours, that had elapsed between the deadline that Commerce had established and the receipt of the information. And they said that Dong Tai Peak had been entirely capable of at least submitting an extension request on time. I do think that's a similarity, but it seems quite different here, Your Honor, in that, again, I believe everybody acknowledges that there was a mistake that was made. They filed when they thought it was due. Here, Dong Tai Peak, I was not involved with that case, Your Honor, but they appear to have gone past the deadline and then decided to basically, submit an extension request retroactively and then waited even more time to file. Here, in terms of the effect on Commerce and, for that matter, on Mr. Meisner and other parties in the case, there's been no explanation that the 5 hours was different, whereas in that case it was, 10 days between the time. And as we said before, you still had 45 days for the preliminary results, and they could have obviously extended the time for the final results to consider information after the fact. I did want to come back to that point about the preliminary and the final. I think it is relevant, Your Honor, that this is an administrative review. As we all know, in the original investigation, the preliminary determination has very significant consequences on the parties because it establishes the cash deposit rate as of the publication in the Federal Register. So there, you really need a very well-established, well-thought-out preliminary determination. Here, of course, in the preliminary results, you'd like to have that. But the reality is that administrative review, because there is no change in deposit rate, because there is no setting of the assessment rate in the preliminary results, Commerce does have more flexibility after a preliminary results than in an original investigation. I do think that's important.
I mean, they typically perform verification. If they're performing verification, it occurs before prelim.
Right. That can't be a review. Although, if anything, I think when all of us were young in the practice, that was Commerce's way. Now they've changed it a bit. Where even in reviews, now they're sometimes conducting verifications after the fact. I think the Commerce Department is busy, and we understand that. But I do think that the fact that in a review, you have more flexibility, and that the preliminary determination doesn't actually establish anything at the border, I think, is material. So they really had not just the 45 days for the preliminary results, but they had quite a bit of additional time whereby they could have reached the right result, calculated an accurate margin as required by Rome Blanc and other cases, Your Honor, in order to do that.
Well, but Rome Blanc doesn't say that Commerce can't enforce its deadlines or anything like that. It's just that the idea is to be accurate. The idea is to be accurate. It doesn't, but within the context of the circumstances.
No, that's right. Again, I come back to, again, these cases were before the regulation, but still, I think the artisan, the robust, all these cases, I think, talk about the reasonableness of the approach. You have to balance these things. And so, again, when you look at the facts of this case, again, compared to, for example, Dong Tai Peak, where it seems like they blew past the deadline without really caring too much and then took a lot longer to respond after the deadline had passed, I do think there's a situation where Antique Group acted in good faith, and that is a very clear distinguishing factor between that and the Federal Circuit's holding in that case, Your Honor. Thank you.
Ms. Arden, anything to add?
Sazi Arden from Trade Pacific for Antique Group. I would just like to say that Dante's case, the facts are not analogous to Antique Group. First, in Dante, the court found that Dante Peak was capable of submitting at least an extension request on time. Here, Antique Group was not capable of submitting an extension request on time, as Antique Group did not know a 10 a.m. deadline was possible. Second, Indocte Commerce did weigh the interests of finality, accuracy, and provided an adequate explanation, where in our case, Commerce did not weigh interest and provide explanation. The deadline in that case were important, which Commerce noted. The deadlines in this case were important because in two prior reviews, Commerce found Dongte Peak's United States sales to be not bona fide, a determination that requires careful consideration of the totality of the circumstances. The court found that Commerce fully explained that its need for a significant amount of time and effort to gather the necessary information, consider the facts of the record, and provide interested parties with an appropriate period for comments and rebuttal comments. Here, Commerce did not do any of these. Third, in Dongte, the respondent had been warned about filing extension requests late and the importance of submitting documents on time. Here, there was no such warning to Antique Group, as Antique Group is a compliant respondent that submits documents on time and accurately. Fourth, in Dongte, the extension request was filed 2 days after the deadline of the submission. Antique Group was completely compliant in all filings and submitted its extension request immediately after realizing that its one document was late on the same day.
Thank you. Mr. Mathias, in some ways this really goes more to you, because I think it was the government trying to rely on Dongte Peak, and I mean, arguably, as I think illustrated by the comments this morning, I mean, or this afternoon, sorry, pretty different case.
Mr. Mathias, for the Department of Justice, Your Honor, I... Yes, we relied on Dongte Peak in our brief. The lateness of the document in Dongte Peak is especially different compared to this case. You are correct, Your Honor. Dongte Peak does exist before the advent of the extraordinary circumstances standard. It's only judged under the good cause standard, so the burden has been only increased since this decision. And I just want to emphasize...
Is the government's basic position that now with the extraordinary circumstances regulation that it's not going to accept mistakes by counsel? I mean, if you make a mistake, you miss calendar, you're out of luck, period.
Your Honor, these decisions are always very fact-dependent.
What are the specific facts of this case that suggest that Commerce took into account? 5 hours late on the day, between 10 and 5 on the, you know, before the regulatory time frame on the deadline. I mean, this is, you know, you're saying words, but you're not putting it, you're not really relating it to the facts of your case.
Yes, Your Honor, there.
Let me be clear. I mean, part of, if you haven't gathered, I mean, this doesn't look good, okay, for the agency in the grand scheme of things. I mean, I'm not, and this isn't about necessarily the result. I mean, I'm not looking at this as a results-driven thing. I'm trying to put things into the context of honest people make honest mistakes, okay? And so when the agency has to look at submissions that say, hey, I made a mistake, the agency makes mistakes too. The agency has to look at that and accept the fact that people are human, and they have to evaluate them on the facts. You know, help me understand. Fine, Dongte Peak is a lousy case for you. The facts are, I mean, it doesn't, it's not a particularly helpful case for you, let's put it that way, because the facts are so different. What are the facts of this case that are helpful to you? Other than, you got bold typeface.
Your Honor, the position of the United States is that in this case, when the explanation is we we didn't read the bolded language and missed that it was the deadline was 10 a.m. and that is the only this is in their briefs. This is in their that is the real reason the submission was late. That will not meet extraordinary cause.
Would that be an excusable neglect standard?
Your Honor, I defer to the court on whether that meets the excusable neglect standard.
So are you telling me now, I mean, let's go back to the original question that I asked you here, that an honest mistake, a miscalendaring mistake, is where the deadline is plainly stated in the questionnaire, will never constitute extraordinary circumstances? Because that seems to be what you just said. Whether, you know, I mean, as long as it's bold, or let me stipulate, as long as the deadline is stated in bold in the question, I'm not being facetious about it. I mean, that seems to be all you've got. That's all you're telling me. It was stated there in bold and they missed it, so they must have been sloppy about it.
One moment, Your Honor. Your Honor, I will rely on the regulations language. Oh, this is the preamble regulation. That there are clear examples Commerce says qualifies extraordinary circumstances and also clearly states that unlikely to be considered are inattentiveness, and that's what this case is.
So you're saying, so the answer is yes. You miss a deadline by an honest calendaring mistake when we've told you what the deadline is and you're out of luck, period.
That is the position of the United States.
Okay. All right.
Your Honor, Luke Meisner here. I'll just jump in with a couple of brief comments. First is...
Let me just go back to, you know, Mr. Mathias. But apparently, you know, unless you're talking about the tomato suspension agreement and the government really, really, really wants to look at and use the information provided... Right? That seems to be an exception where there's no excuse whatsoever.
Your Honor, I don't know the details of the tomato suspension case. This is a second supplemental questionnaire. Recognizing already a delay to the administrative proceedings, the second supplemental questionnaire was required because of discrepancies in previous data.
But at the time Commerce, I mean, I hear you, but at the time Commerce made the decision to go back and say, well, we're not really, this thing was late and we're not going to do it, they already knew that, in fact, the respondent provided the response 4 to 5 hours late. So it's not like it was, you know, days late or anything else. I mean, they... You know, if you look at it in the grand scheme of things, you know, they said, well, it was late. Okay. Yeah, we made a mistake. We didn't realize 10 o'clock versus 5 o'clock. And by the way, did you notice we filed by 5 o'clock on that date?
Your Honor, I have to rely on the language of the regulation.
Right. Okay. Sorry, Mr. Meisner.
Okay. Really briefly, Your Honor, I do think it makes a difference that this was a second supplemental questionnaire. It wasn't an original questionnaire. I think it makes a difference that Antique...
Well, I mean, yes and no, Mr. Meisner. I mean, come on. I mean, you know, sometimes if it's the original questionnaire, you say, well, gee, are these guys even paying attention? I mean, the way to turn that around on you is to say, yeah, and all their prior responses were filed on time. They've established a track record of responding and participating in a timely fashion.
But I think the point is it was a supplemental questionnaire with over 60 questions, so it showed that Antique had not, you know, was not responding already to the best of its ability. And
again, that evaluation wasn't made until after it was plain that the submission was in fact made. I mean, this, you know, and made on the day. I mean, these other facts were there.
That's
right?
Fine, Your Honor. But I think the other more critical point is that Antique itself had already asked for one extension and had been granted that extension, and then had already also requested a second extension and had been granted that extension. So it, would it be fair for Commerce to put a per se rule down that it will never allow a miscalendar date to be the basis for extraordinary circumstances?
This wasn't a miscalendared
maybe,
date.
Maybe not.
This was a miscalendared time that was inconsistent with the time that's established in Commerce's regulations.
I think when you're asking for a second extension request and it's granted,
okay.
If it was me, if I was cooperating to the best of my ability, I would grab that piece of paper and I'd look at it very carefully, especially any bolded language. And if I missed any bolded language under those circumstances, that...
You ever missed a deadline, Mr. Meisner?
I have, Your Honor, yes.
Okay. Did you, in that particular circumstance, go back and had you gone back and... you know, relooked at the time frame. I mean, I'm not trying to cast aspersions. I mean, the fact is we all make mistakes. I mean, what I'm trying to figure out here is, you know, where's the common sense? You know, I mean, above all things out. I mean, what I was giving Ms. Erden a hard time on the first question. Okay, 1A, and this is the one that, you know, none of you really honed in on, is it's a reasonableness standard here. It's got to be, you know, what the agency's actions at the end of the day have to be reasonable. And you got to think about, well, gee, we changed the deadline from the regulatory time frame of 5 to 10. Okay, did we have any reason? Was that a reasonable thing to have done? Okay, in the first instance, well, we didn't provide any explanation for it. We didn't discuss it. And, oh, in the particular facts of this case, it, you know, what were the subsequent events of it? The party missed it, but also filed by the regulatory time frame of 5 p.m. In the construct of those facts, is it reasonable for us to say, gee, you know, when they come in and said, we just made a mistake and, you know, we miscalendered, we missed the 10 a.m. We got the date right, but we missed the 10 a.m. time frame. Honest mistake. Is any of this reasonable, any of what the consequences, the specific consequence of rejecting their submission at that point, you know, several days later, okay, 5 hours late, Commerce takes days to decide, okay, we're not going to do it, and takes itself through this whole multiple write-up exercise to decide, you know, okay, hand-wringing time, do we accept this or not? Okay, how much time did they waste on that exercise where, you know, versus the 5 hours? Okay, did the agency act with any degree of reasonableness here? That's what I'm struggling to find, and I'm struggling to put it in the context where I'm not saying, okay, yeah, respondents can ignore any deadline and file anything late, okay? Trying to figure out some appropriate line between those two things. And the problem is y'all are not necessarily helping me out here.
But my response to that, Your Honor, would be I agree it's a line-drawing exercise. And so where do you draw the line? You know, is it...
But the line is, Mr. Meisner, you got to start with that reasonableness.
5 hours late.
Put it in, give me a context here that explains why what happened was reasonable. That's the line, okay? And if you have something to offer up for me that explains, that puts this in reasonable terms, that the agency was acting reasonably here, I'm happy to hear it, but, you know, this whole, you know, the slippery slope thing, and, you know, at the end, if I force the agency to accept this submission,
gee, then they can't make up any deadlines anymore. That is ridiculous. That's not a that's not going to be a helpful response.
I mean, that would be my response, Your Honor. It's reasonable in the context of Commerce trying to administer the hundreds of orders that it has and making sure that parties meet the deadlines. And so it says,
but that says that no extent that there's never that after a fact after the fact extension, you know, that says there's no extraordinary circumstances, basically. Not even
right.
That.
That's how they decided to.
I mean, I get it from a petitioner standpoint that that's desirable because it will lead to that many more instances of facts available or adverse facts available. But I think even, you know, you're not going to win that case at the Federal Circuit. The Federal Circuit's already decided that, you know, you can't just sort of say the deadline, and we're going to put on blinders and, you know, ignore everything else and just go to facts available.
Look, I think the way Commerce has decided to do it is they've said the deadline's the deadline, and we'll only accept after the fact extension requests where there's extraordinary circumstances. So if you miss the deadline and it's not because of extraordinary circumstances, then the deadline is the deadline. And I do think that's a reasonable way for Commerce to run its operations. It might not be the only way. It might not be the only reasonable way. There might be other reasonable ways to run it. You know, I mean, some people are stricter. Some people are more lenient. But I think Commerce has chosen a reasonable but strict approach in administering the deadlines.
Okay. I don't know if we want, you know, if there's anything more. I mean, we've sort of gotten beyond Dante Peak in any case. And four is just sort of another variation on this, just in terms of the 5-hour delay and such. I mean, anybody want to speak to question four in particular? And I mean, is there anything that we haven't covered already? I mean, if it's simply more of the same, I don't know that it's necessarily going to be a productive exercise. But if you've got something additional to, in the context of this question, I'm happy to hear it.
If I could do four, I have a little bit about Grabest in there.
Okay.
We do believe that Commerce puts in a lot of effort to review supplemental questionnaires. However, a 5-hour delay is insignificant to calculate an anti-dumping duty margin. Commerce failed to explain how the 5-hour delay filed on the due date and within business hours burdened Commerce. Commerce's decision to reject anti-group supplemental questionnaire response was an abuse of discretion because the delay was immaterial and inconsequential to conducting the administrative review. In Grabest, the CIP found that Commerce abuses its discretion when it rejects documents based on a purported interest in timeliness and finality when the burden placed on Commerce is low and timeliness of a proceeding is not threatened. In this case, Commerce explained that it could not accept anti-group submission because it hinders the timely conduct of its proceeding, but the facts speak for themselves. Anti-group's response was submitted on the due date only 5 hours after the very, very rare 10 a.m. deadline. In fact, the anti-group believed its submission to have been filed timely, as it is Commerce's practice to establish 5 p.m. deadlines. After the filing, the preliminary results were issued 45 days later, and the final results were issued 228 days later. So there was a 5-hour delay with 228 days left for the final results. In Grabest, a submission was 95 days late, with 7 months remaining for the final results. And Commerce's interest in finality does not outweigh the agency's mandate to calculate anti-dumping duty rates with fairness and accuracy. Here, anti-group filing was only 5 hours late, with more than 7 months remaining until the final results, and therefore there was not any hindrance to Commerce. Commerce did not provide substantial evidence or any evidence that the 5-hour delay meaningfully hindered Commerce. In fact, Commerce stated the burden associated with a single late filed response may be perceived as minimal, but the burden is not minimal when aggregated across all proceedings. Commerce's other proceedings are irrelevant to this proceeding, as Commerce investigates proceedings individually as stated by Commerce, and even if this were true, Commerce did not identify any other late filings in any other proceedings that burdened it cumulatively. Commerce must make a rational connection between the facts found and the determination made. The truth is, Commerce did not provide an explanation, because in reality, a five-hour delay in response could not have burdened Commerce. As seen from the tomato case, which we projected, these decisions are very arbitrary. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay. Anybody else want to add anything on four?
There you are.
Thank you. Okay. Let's turn to five, and in a sense, I think it's directed for the most part to the government, just in term. And I mean, keep in mind again that right now we're still doing this in a public setting, so if we can just talk about the characteristic. I mean, does the government dispute the Arizona Tile's characterization of the characteristic of the transactions that were used to corroborate the AFA rate?
Colin Mathias for the Department of Justice. No, the government does not dispute that characterization.
Okay. All right. That's, I think, all that I had on the corroboration issue. I don't know. Does anybody else want to speak to the issue? I mean, I understand it. I understand the concerns that were raised. Okay. All right. Moving on. Albemarle, expected method, et cetera. Who wants to start there? Mr. Mathias, do you want to?
Yes, Your Honor, give me one moment.
Let me sort of focus the question that much more. I mean, Albemarle had its own set of facts, okay? Maybe another set of facts that you'd consider is the case that the government didn't cite in their initial brief. I think it was more focus of Arizona Tile that, is prime source, okay? One of the things that, in prime source that was relevant there was the fact that, the government said, Commerce said, hey, look, we're not going to depart from the expected method because in the history, rates are kind of all over the place. Sometimes they're AFA, sometimes they're calculated and relatively low. So, okay, we just got to, we're just going to deal with whatever the contemporaneous rates are within the particular review and apply the expected method. Here, I'm struggling to understand the agency's justification for departure because the comment of that there's a history, well, there's a history of one, the investigation, and that's it. And in fact, what I'm trying to get at here with this question is, why doesn't this circumstance, this administrative review with the finding of AFA constitute, start us down a path that maybe ends up being more like prime source? Yeah, sometimes they participate and provide usable information and we do calculated rates, sometimes they don't. So I'm trying to understand, how much history does there have to be for the agency to find that there's a history to justify departure from the expected method? Because there ain't much here.
Your Honor, I need not remind you very much of prime source, but one distinction I will point out is that prime source reviewed on the substantial evidence standard is that Commerce's decision was reasonable to stay with the expected method. Here, we are now reviewing Commerce's decision for substantial evidence to depart from the expected method.
And but I think the other part of prime source is to say, where's the burden lie? So the question is, did the agency meet, it's substantial evidence that they met a burden that justified departing from the expected method? That's what I'm reviewing for substantial evidence.
Yes, Your Honor, I recognize that a corroborated AFA, if you were to conclude that this was a properly corroborated AFA rate, is some amount of contemporaneous data. That is, the Commerce does treat it like that way. In this review, I would suggest that we have three calculated rates, two very low, I believe 2.19 and 5.06.
Single digits.
Single digits.
Nowhere close to 300%+.
Yes. Then a de minimis rate for the other respondent, and then a corroborated AFA rate. Commerce can reasonably look at that as a historical set and determine that using the AFA rate.
So does that mean in the seventh administrative review of nails from wherever, that if in the sixth administrative review everybody participated and the agency calculated single digit margins for everybody, that the immediate history should carry some weight, so that in the seventh review maybe they should depart and not give consideration to the AFA rate and depart from the expected method and go back to the sixth review? Because that's the equivalent amount of history, most relevant history, and contemporaneous history that we're dealing with here.
Yes.
The agency can't have it both ways, okay? I'm trying to figure things out here. You can't say we're going to depart when we want to depart, but when somebody else wants us to depart, you know, the equivalent amount of history isn't good enough. I'm trying to help you. I'm trying to understand a standard, and I'm trying to help me understand what the agency's real standard is here.
Your Honor, it's difficult to identify the real standard because Commerce can only work with the information it has available to it, and it's different from prior and source because there were so many years of review. Commerce is stuck with imperfect options in this case, Commerce has the expertise to decide the most reasonable approach based off of the imperfect options available to it. If there was more history, prime source is not equivalent because there is more history. Here, Commerce has the information it has. They're not equivalent situations.
Why? That's a conclusion. That's not an explanation.
The why is the why is that there's just not there's not the same amount of history.
Fine.
Yeah.
But then explain to me why less history is given more weight. Here, I mean, you're saying, well, yeah, this is different than prime source because we have very limited history here and we had a lot of history there. But why are you giving so much weight to so little history?
We're giving so much weight to so little history because the expected method says if it would gives Commerce the discretion to determine when something would be reasonably reflective of potential dumping margins. That means Commerce provided its reasons for why the expected method would not reasonably reflect it here because of the limited history.
But how is that consistent with, all right, let's try a different approach here, okay? Part of what I tried to explain in Prime Source, what I thought the Federal Circuit was saying in Albemarle too, and that is, if you wanted to, the expected methodology is exactly that. It's the expected methodology. It's the default. That's where you start. Okay? You want to move away from it? Well, what you need to do is you need to explain why. You need to justify it. And it's not just that history justifies it. They said, I mean, what they were talking about in Albemarle too was you got to have some, I mean, because obviously history is what you're pulling from. And you wouldn't go to history if it were the same as the contemporaneous. But the question is, is there something in the contemporaneous information that suggests that the expected methodology, where you're relying on the results of the selected individual respondents that are selected to speak on behalf of the others because they're expected to be representative of the rest, do you have contemporaneous data that supports the idea that the results you found with respect to the selected respondents is not, in fact, representative of the other respondents for whom they're the respondents that are not selected? In other words, is there contemporaneous data that says, gee, there's something different this time around? Not the historical data per se. We have contemporaneous data that says these guys are not representative, and therefore, based on the contemporaneous finding that they're not representative, that's the justification for going to the historical information. Not that the historical information is just different, because it's always different. Okay? What's the contemporaneous data that the agency found to justify its departure from the expected methodology?
So the contemporaneous data that is a component of the AFA rate is sourced from PESL's data.
It's corroborated by
PESL's data. That same data, when used,
which normally would result in the agency saying, hey, look, it's not just the AFA company that's up here, but even the company that ended up with a de minimis rate, in fact, during this period, has transactions at really high margins. And therefore, we're going to just, that's the contemporaneous data supports our decision to rely on the expected method. That's how the conversation normally works. So what's the contemporaneous data that is distinct from that?
Yeah. Honor, do you mind if I take a shot?
Sure. Okay. Although I'm not sure you really want to take that shot, right? Well, no, but I mean, well, you want to take, sorry, I mean, you don't want to take, you really want to take the shot that, well, you, I guess, yeah, you do. Never mind. Sorry. I've got you.
No, that's okay. There's a little bit of,
you know, yeah, I know. We need three sets of tables here. Remember where everybody belongs.
No, Your Honor, but in this case, you have two pieces of contemporaneous data on the record. You have the Bocarna margin, and then you have the AFA margin.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason why the department preferenced the Bocarna margin rather than the AFA margin was because there was nothing representative in that AFA margin based on how the AFA occurred. So if you go back to Prime Source, you had two respondents that basically told the department, we're not going to participate. We're going to take, you know, we're presumptively the two biggest companies.
I mean, but that was part of what I was talking about in Prime Source. Mm-hmm. I mean, the presumption is from the get-go, the representativeness decision is not based on what the margin is. It's based on the size of the companies made very early in the administrative review. And then let the chips fall where they may.
But, Your Honor, softly, I don't think that's the case when you have a respondent that made, I think everybody agrees, a calendaring mistake. I think, as Counsel Francis said, tried to participate, made a calendaring mistake, but tried.
Right.
This is not the case, as in PrimeSource, where the department could logically conclude somebody decided not to participate, somebody decided to come up with a fake map of Korea, you know, name all the great horror stories of malfeasance. This was a simple mistake, and I think...
thrown out the window, yeah, we know.
Exactly. Everybody, we tell the associates.
Great.
But I think in that case, the AFA rate is not probative of the separate respondents, because there's none of that gamesmanship where Commerce could assume that gamesmanship occurred. Gamesmanship occurs because the thinking is they're going to get a presumptively high rate and we'll apply AFA. That's not the case here, Your Honor.
Did the agency adopt that? Because, I mean, the problem is if the agency adopts that rationale, it undermines a whole lot about their decision to rely on AFA.
Correct.
And to even, you know, to not grant the extension and, you know, all the parade of horribles that followed.
Correct, but I do think if you look at the issue of decision memo, I mean, that was the discussion. The discussion was, here's Picarno's rate, you know, Picarno's rate was a zero. That is supported by the past. It's also supported by the future. In AR3, the rates were all de minimis. And I know in protein, that was something that got brought up. The AR3 rates were at a certain level. People were cherry picking, well, this rate. You said, well, look at the AR4 rates. So I do think Congress can also look at the AR2 rates, to go back to AR1. So I think when you take Picarno's rate, when you take the history of rates, when you take the fact that this AFA rate is different than the AFA rates that might provide some form of information to Commerce about what the rate should actually be because of the act of AFA itself, and then you take those AR2 rates, I think you put all it together, and I think that is substantial evidence, Your Honor.
Mr. Meisner.
This is the same brief issue.
Right.
I think Your Honor understands this issue well, but I want to underscore a couple of points. First is the limited nature of the history of the order and how that could ever justify a departure from the expected method. Because Cambria's perspective, as we came into this first review, was that the margins that were based on the large exporters were way too low and did not reflect the dumping of the smaller exporters. Cambria was sorely disappointed with the results of the original investigation. That's because, you know, if the court will indulge me, Cambria had first filed cases against China, and within a year of winning those cases, an entire new industry had sprung up in India that used Chinese equipment, Chinese workforce, Chinese expertise, a lot of Chinese ownership. But there were also a couple of large established producers, such as Picarno in India. And we continue to believe that Picarno has different production and pricing behavior than the smaller Indian exporters that sprung up in the wake of the order on Chinese port surface products. And so in the first administrative review, Cambria did not even request a review of Picarno and some of the larger exporters because we wanted to get a review of the smaller exporters that had just come into existence in the wake of the order on China. And the other side requested a review, even though Picarno and Antique already had low rates from the original investigation. When it came time for respondent selection, we pleaded with Commerce. We said, please do not select the top two exporters. We want to get to the smaller ones. And we presented evidence, including the historical data showing that Picarno and Antique had lower rates in the original investigation, to say, look, we think there's a difference between them.
No, you're not appealing their decision to pick the top two.
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. We're not appealing that. But and this is the point I'm trying to drive to. In its response, well, first of all, let me say the respondents, many of whom are here today, said, oh, no, there's nothing unrepresentative about the dumping margins that will result from the top two exporters, if that's what Commerce selects. And Commerce, in its respondent selection memorandum, said the same thing. It said, we're not going to use our random sampling methodology to pick the mandatory respondents because the history of this order is too limited to find reason that the top two exporters' pricing behavior and ultimately their dumping margins would be unrepresentative of the remaining non-selected respondents. So we get to the prelim. Commerce follows the expected method. It doesn't find any contemporaneous data that would show anything to the contrary. Now, all of a sudden, we get to the final. There's been no new evidence, no new contemporaneous data placed on the record between respondent selection time and the prelim results and the final results. And all of a sudden, Commerce finds, contrary to its initial determination, that the history of the order is robust enough and sufficient to depart from the expected method. And Commerce never explains this contradiction in its findings, this blatant inconsistency. So that's a major problem with the final results. The other point I wanted to make sure I underscored, because I think Your Honor understands there, there's no contemporaneous data on the record. Commerce relied purely on historical data, the original investigation. But there actually was, under the statute and the statement of an administrative action and cases such as Albemarle, Cambria never had to show that there was contemporaneous data supporting use of the expected method. The expected method, the so-called expected method, is expected. The burden is on Commerce to depart from it. But in fact, there was contemporaneous data. Involves some DPI, so I won't get into it, but it's in our brief. Involves the price data, contemporaneous data regarding the pricing behavior of the large and smaller exporters. And this data, in fact, supported using the expected method. Commerce never addressed that data. Finally, one last point on the relevance of the adverse facts available rate, which I think gets to the heart of Your Honor's question. It certainly is relevant. And the SAA says, when you're faced with this kind of situation, you have nothing but zero rates and AFA rates. Then the expected method is to average those two rates together to get the rate for the non-selected respondents. So Congress has deemed the AFA rate not only relevant, but an essential variable in the calculation of the all others rate when you're in this kind of situation. So it's absolutely relevant. And in Prime Source, this court rejected an argument that a rate that's based on AFA is not relevant contemporaneous data. It said, examining only the calculated margins and excluding from consideration the AFA-based margins would not have yielded a full picture of the historical trend. Now, for the first time, we're hearing from our friends at Hogan Lovells. Well, there's different kinds of AFA rates. There's AFA rates based on throwing documents out the window. There's AFA rates based on missing a deadline. There's AFA for just refusing to cooperate in general. Statute doesn't say anything about that. There's no case law that says anything about that. And Commerce certainly did not say that. And again, as Your Honor pointed out, that would totally undermine the basis for applying the rate that Commerce did to Antique, which was corroborated by contemporaneous data. I mean, if Commerce didn't believe in that rate and thought it was not relevant, then it could have picked another rate, maybe a 50% rate, which wasn't as high based on some other evidence on the record. But Commerce believed in the 320% rate. It was corroborated. It was in the petition. It was corroborated by contemporaneous data. So there's no merit to this notion that you can distinguish between the relevance of different kinds of AFA rates. I said that was my last point, but I may have one other, Your Honor. Pardon me. And again, this gets to the heart of the question, which is in Prime Source, this court found, well, where rates are fluctuating significantly. You got low rates in the prior segment, and then they all of a sudden jump up in the next segment, even if it's because of AFA. I mean, that shows that things have changed. You can't always rely on history to determine what's happening in the present. And you know, another reason the historical rates from the original investigation, if they ever could be relevant, were especially not relevant in this case, is because none of the historical rates involved the non-selected respondents in the first review. So one of the non-selected respondents in this review is Quartzo. Let's say Commerce and the original investigation had calculated a rate of 3% for Quartzo. Then Quartzo became a non-selected respondent in the first review. Well, under the case law, that still wouldn't matter. But if it ever did matter, then the fact that Quartzo had shown in the immediate past that it had a low dumping margin perhaps would be more relevant. But the fact here are that none of the historical rates pertain to the non-selected respondents. So they certainly could not justify a departure from the expected method. So for all these reasons, as well as the reasons in our briefs, we respectfully request that the court remand to Commerce with instructions to follow the expected method. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Mathias, did you want to add anything? I mean, I connect Mr. Wessel's argument to the IND memo, and
I don't think we don't have anything further, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Let's turn then to number 7. Fairly straightforward, the export subsidy offset. You know, if I don't buy that it's a yes, we're still here, Bruce. Sorry. if I don't buy that it was if I agree with the government that it's not a ministerial error. Question is whether Arizona Tile has exhausted its administrative remedies with regard to arguing it from a methodological standpoint.
May I approach, Your Honor?
Please.
Thank you.
Jonathan Stoll again for Mega John. Before I address number 7, I just wanted to make two comments in response to Mr. Meisner's excellent commentary there. I mean, I think it is important to remember, Your Honor, this is an administrative review, and so Commerce has some discretion in how it applies the. We don't agree that it's the expected method, but for purposes of this discussion, let's call it the expected method. And the reason for why it's important is that, as you know, Your Honor knows well from your experience with Commerce, you have an administrative review, the possibility of the assessment of dumping duties that could impose very substantial costs upon importers. And it's important to point out here, we're talking about the non-selected respondents. They didn't have an opportunity to participate. As you know, the law actually says that they should be entitled to their own rate. Commerce should be selecting them. And
well, but the law also says Commerce, when the number is large, Commerce can select. And the idea there is that the selected are expected to be representative of everybody else. I understand there's always arguments about big and little guys not being the same. That's always, you know, those arguments are always always there in just about every administrative review.
But I think that Mr. Russell's comment, you know, and this goes, it does unfortunately tie into our antique discussion, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. We are selecting what's clearly a very punitive margin. I don't think anybody disputes at 323 when Picard is getting zero. It's hard to, at least in my mind, Your Honor, to see that as remedial as opposed to punitive. And so I think to be punishing folks who are not selected with 161% margin based on the historical outcome, apparently when, as Mr. Russell pointed out, in AR2, Commerce ended up with zeros for everybody, it does suggest that there's something that's not correct about that. But moving on to Your Honor.
One of the challenges is I'm not sure how much of that is really reflected in the IND memo in terms of Commerce's own rationale. And that's what I have to review, is their rationale.
Understood, John.
Yeah.
Well, just in terms of your question seven, I think I just want to start off by saying I think it's not in dispute that Commerce is required to offset export subsidies, as your Honor has suggested. That's clear from the statute, 1677AC, Your Honor. It's also clear that the statute talks about shall. So this is a mandatory obligation. I think it's also not in dispute, looking at the final results, Your Honor, that Commerce did not offset any export subsidies for the non-selected response. That's interesting, Your Honor, because in the final results Federal Register notice, Commerce indicated, and we pointed this out in our brief, Your Honor, that it would go ahead and continue to offset for those who are not part of the review, what are the true all others. And so Commerce seemed to understand that it did have an obligation to offset export subsidies, but it didn't do that. Now to the question that Your Honor has asked about whether or not we exhausted remedies. I'd like to start off by pointing out to Your Honor that under 28 U.S.C. 2637D, exhaustion is not something that the court has to look at. It's a discretionary question for you, Your Honor, and so we would suggest that's not necessary here. But let me explain why, even if it is, we don't believe that exhaustion was required here. And that's because, as you've just discussed and been discussing with Mr. Matthias, with Mr. Wessel, and Mr. Meiser, there was, in fact, a very big change between the preliminary results in terms of how Commerce calculated the rate to the non-selected respondents and the final results. We argued that in the final, and Commerce agreed with us, that you should use a pulled forward rate. But it was not apparent to us at the time of the preliminary results that Commerce would not follow the law. I mean, the law requires that they go ahead and deduct an export subsidy. We assumed that they would based on what we asked for, but that was not at all apparent in the preliminary results. There was no indication that they were not going to go ahead and do something that was required by law. So that's why we raised it as a ministerial error. Our view, Your Honor, as we explained to Commerce in our ministerial error allegations, was this was a pure copying error, because in the final results, and I know Your Honor is very familiar with these, you have the two columns where you have the calculated margin and then you have the deposit rate because of the original investigation. That obviously was not done in the final results, and that was, from our perspective, Your Honor, why this was in fact a ministerial error as opposed to, in Commerce's verbiage, a methodological choice. We would submit that if it was a methodological choice, then, as I said, the statute requires plainly on its face, the text requires that Commerce do that. And I would point, Your Honor, to two cases that I think were relevant on the exhaustion question, if Your Honor decides to exercise the court's discretion. First is that in Korrestal, the Federal Circuit said that the agency's change between the preliminary determination and the case briefs is something that a party could not have known, Your Honor. So that's exactly the situation that we're faced with here.
You argued for this particular change. Albeit, you know, on an assumption.
That is correct, Your Honor. And I think I would go beyond just an assumption. It was an assumption that Commerce would follow the law. I think that's a reasonable assumption. If we were asking Commerce to do something novel, if we were coming in our ministerial errors and saying, no, Commerce, you made this calculation, but we think actually you should have divided it instead of multiplied, even though historically you've always divided. I think that would be different in a situation where we expected that Commerce would follow the law. And similarly, Your Honor, in Zhao King PIFO, this court has talked about how you have to be put on notice. It has to be very plain and clear notice. It's not just we're supposed to somehow assume that Commerce might do something. We had to be clearly on notice that the agency was not going to do something in order to make that argument. We would respectfully submit, Your Honor, that looking at the preliminary results, we in good faith believe that Commerce would follow the law. The agency didn't do that, and that's why we're here before you today on this particular issue, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honor, is there any
Mr. Matthias for the Department of Justice. If I just want to point, Your Honor, to Arizona Tile's administrative case brief before Commerce, in which it requested that Commerce specifically pull forward the 3.19% rate and use and apply that rate to the non-selected respondents in this proceeding. This is Arizona Tile received the rate it advocated for in its case brief. It knew this issue was at play, and it did not make further arguments about this. Under Boomerang Tube, they should have been aware and did not raise this. As a result, it's not exhausted. Unless Your Honor has any further questions.
Nope.
Nothing further here, Your Honor.
Okay. I did promise you, anything else in this question? Okay. And I promised you at the beginning an opportunity, well, two opportunities at the end. One is if there's other general arguments that you want to make that we haven't already beaten to death by this point. Anybody have anything further that they feel they need to hit?
No.
Okay. And then the last thing is with respect to BPI, is there anything, do we need to have any further discussion in terms of a closed session?
No, Your Honor. I think you made it clear you understand the arguments as to why we think it was, you know, aberrational, punitive, and non-corroborative. So I don't think we need to have a closed session.
Okay. All right?
We agree.
Okay. And you're all getting hungry, and you're like, it's been 2 hours already. You know? Okay. All right. Well, with that, it'll take the case under submission and get a decision out as soon as possible. Thank you all.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. This honorable court now stands adjourned.
Yeah.